Taking Stock on Newstalk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is Vincent Wall with you on Newstalk's Taking Stock. We're joined now by Steve Dempsey, Group Director of Publishing Products at Independent News and Media. Steve, thanks for joining us again for our pretty regular chat about the world of big tech and media.
Pleasure as ever.
Now, we've talked before about what's happening in Australia, the phenomenal situation in Australia where the Australian government is pushing legislation through to try to force the big social media platforms, Google and Facebook in particular, to pay for some of the third-party news content that that is shared on those platforms.
I mean, yeah, just to remind everyone of what's going on here, I mean, this all dates back to 2019 when an inquiry found that the kind of tech companies were taking a disproportionate share of online advertising, even though a lot of their content came from media organizations. That was the finding then. And the fallout from that was the proposition of a draft code that would allow Australian news businesses to negotiate fair payments for their journalist work. And that would include going in and negotiating with Facebook and Google. And there was also a kind of a third party court of arbitration that would allow for penalties and decide on fees and whatnot if that needed to be called into action. So really, this is an attempt to address the imbalance between big tech and legacy media companies. So in some ways, I mean, my very cynical take on this is it's plucky internet startups like Facebook and Google at war with small Australian news outlets like Rupert Murdoch's News Corp.
You've been too long in this business. You're too cynical, Steve.
Possibly. I think in some ways that, I mean, the aims here are quite noble. I mean, we're talking about kind of a rebalancing of how we get information. But in some ways, it seems to me that the legislation is quite hokey in terms of how it's going about doing this. So remind everyone that, again, this is about rebalancing online ad impact. So, you know, I think in Australia, for every 100 dollars spent on advertising, on online advertising, Google gets 53, Facebook takes 28, and the rest is shared amongst the media outlets. Now, Google and Facebook have built really advanced and really impressive digital ad products, and they're not news companies, they're big advertising companies. Google sells on interest. I want to buy Nike shoes, and you search and Google will serve you an ad. Google sells an intention. I want to buy the Nike shoes, and Facebook sells on interest. I love Nike shoes, and therefore I can be targeted with ads for Nike shoes in that way. And legacy media propositions, certainly in the digital sphere, are far less targeted. They can offer contextual ads based on the content or the sectors, and they can use kind of DMPs and first-party data to improve their offering. But still, they're always playing catch-up with Google and Facebook and others who entered this online space not from a news position, but they really understand how to use their first-party data and their operations at scale to make more money from the user and in fairness, in many instances, offer a better advertising product. So while it's a noble aim to support journalism and place restrictions on big tech's power, it is skirting very close to protectionism. And I did see one news analyst's verdict that said, I mean, that effectively media blackmail works. Australia does have form when it comes to market intervention, from high wages, gun laws, and kind of soft treatment for indigenous companies like the country's four major banks. But especially when you factor in that the control from Rupert Murdoch and co, it does feel like the means don't justify the end here.
Accepting that point that you make there, that you know, it's not the social media platforms' fault that they're much better at scooping up online advertising than the traditional publishers. Nonetheless, they use, whether it's through Google search engine or through Facebook share platform, they use third party content effectively free to make their platforms more attractive to visit.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that's one of the areas where a level of legitimacy is provided to both Google and Facebook, because they will host and share and allow for the sharing of this content. That said, both Google and Facebook, in their defense, would say, well, I mean, there's an upside for everyone here. We get our users get to share very important content with kind of social context. And as a result, we also then send traffic to these publishers, and they can monetize that through ads if they want, or else they can try and convert the traffic that comes their way into paying subscribers. So, I mean, there's an argument there for that. I do think that the powers of big tech need to be balanced in some way. But I think in sometimes when legislators approach these two problems, two separate problems, one is the support for journalism in a world where information is no longer is very freely available to all, and curbing the power of big tech. When you conflate the two, you actually make it very harder to make a more cogent argument.
That's a fair point. Just stripping it down, though, it's been reported this week that the amount, and we probably will never know what the amount is, the amount that Google has agreed to pay, say, to the likes of Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, could be higher for whatever content they agree to use globally, not just in Australia, could be higher for News Corp than what they would get from this proposed Australian payment system coming in. Why is Google, if that's the case, prepared to pay much more than it might otherwise to be in control of what it pays rather than going through an arbitration system?
Yeah, this is one of the kind of key points in here. And in some ways, I think Google's hand was forced a little bit by the entry of another kind of tech titan into this argument. Last week, Microsoft waded in a very colourful fashion. So previously, Google had said that it was going to pull out of Australia, and not in the same way as Facebook has done. They actually said, we're going to take everything. You won't be able to search for news or news maps. They were leaning on the government, but they were also trying to drum up support amongst local consumers in the Australian market. And certainly it seemed to me like the Google's hand was forced by Microsoft. So following the statement from Google that it might pull out, Microsoft stepped in and reminded everyone that there is another search engine called Bing, and Microsoft has no problem paying for news. So this was wonderful corporate positioning, lovely halo effect for Microsoft. And in fairness to them also, it's true. So Microsoft has been paying publishers for news on its MSN portal for years now, not a huge amount, and I'm sure not as much as Google will be paying to the likes of News Corp, but still, it was true to a certain degree. So I think that, coupled with the fact, and just another kind of strange point about this, is that Google sticking around, if Google had have left, it would have been bad for news in Australia, but it would have been a pathway for jurisdictions to break up big tech monopolies and to actually say, right, this is what happens when we kick Google out. So I actually think Google was being smart and protecting its position in lots of other markets as well. Also, the bigger picture as well, in countries where there might be a slightly anti-American bent, this could have been a very interesting test case for people to see what happens when a large US company is forced to leave the market. So in some ways, Google sticking around it's really, they are looking after their own interests in a lot of other countries, I would say. And let's remember, when it comes to Facebook has said that news counts for 4% of its feed. News is a rounding error for Facebook, and it's still sticking around.
However this turns out in Australia, Steve, we know that other jurisdictions in the broad sense are looking at this whole area. One, as you say, and perhaps they are separate issues, how do you control the alleged misuse of power, perhaps, by some of these big tech platforms? And secondly, how do you support traditional publishing operations, whether they be print or increasingly online? Do you think the Australian experience, as we see it evolving, will influence perhaps what's happening in Europe, what's happening with the Biden administration, and ultimately what might happen here in Ireland?
I think the Australian experience will go on a grand world tour, and they, in the light of this, Australian politicians will see themselves and in some ways legitimately so, as kind of striking a blow against technology. I mean, in some ways, I think they will gain support where there's a very strong legacy media organization that will see this as an opportunity to give themselves a shot in the arm. And in some ways, that's kind of entrenchment. And some startups based on social traffic will completely disappear. But in other areas, there is a legitimate discussion around that. I think in the US, they won't adopt anything like this. I mean, we've seen there's some antitrust probes. There's lots of discussion around Section 230. But they're never going to put media companies' interests ahead of the Silicon Valley cash cows. In Europe, I think we are unlikely to see anything like it, although I know that there has already been a few people kind of saying, yes, this is a good approach. I think Europe has been on a kind of a much slower journey to figure out how it would like its own internet sector to work and what the role is of companies in that. And it's, I think the European approach is far less combative than the Australian approach. So I don't think they will slam the handbrake on that approach and suddenly adopt something like we've seen in Australia. I mean, we have seen similar kind of fierce lobbying around the neighbouring rights issue and the issue of snippets and the copyright directive. But I don't think they're going to be very reluctant to change tack. I mean, I know legislators have been slow to transpose the copyright directive into local law, and it's almost as if politicians across Europe have been busy with something else in the last kind of 12 months. So I think that one needs to kind of play out in Europe. And the same thing applies in Ireland. I don't think there's even been a heads or draft bill on the copyright directive. So we need to see what happens with that. I mean, interestingly, in that kind of legislative vacuum in some areas, Google has created an instrument to try and overcome this. It's rolled out a thing called Showcase in some markets, and it's trying to get publishers on board. I think it's got some German publishers interestingly involved, because German publishers are typically quite allergic to working with Facebook and Google. I think some Brazilian publishers may also be on board. So this is a kind of a tool where Google will host and show content to its users and try and help turn those users into subscribers for the publishers who it's sharing content with. So at best, it's Google, I think, trying to commit to help publishers to turn visitors into regular paying readers and paying for hosting the content. At worst, and again, I don't think this is Google's intention, but sometimes technology companies' intentions aren't always in line with what the outcomes are. But at worst, it could end up being a kind of a Trojan horse that sets a de facto floor price for a copyright that allows Google to minimize its copyright duties in relation to the copyright directive.
And in terms of where additional revenue support may come for what we may call traditional publishers, including your own company, Independent News and Media, Steve, we've seen Google already agree before the News Corp deal that was agreed this week. We've seen them already agree to pass on some fees to publishers in the UK and elsewhere for the content that may find its way onto the platform. Is that necessarily a good thing? Because it ultimately could boil down to private agreements between Google and perhaps larger publishers in a particular jurisdiction, which may ultimately give them a benefit and reduce competition further.
I think that's exactly what the risk is. And I think a lot of those deals, a very similar one has just been announced in France. They could result in just entrenchments. The bigger legacy operations are propped up for a while longer by the digital operations, and you know, any form of innovation in around kind of digital news is stifled. I think that's a real risk.
And you know, if Mr. Google came with a checkbook of sorts to your head office or to the Irish Times down the road, it could prove difficult to say no to them, couldn't it?
I think it really would be. And I think a lot of the commentary around certainly the Australian deal and Showcase and the announcement in France is, okay, like, you know, media organisations are feeling the squeeze. And isn't it good that there is some support being provided, even if it's bad legislation or even if it's not a great deal? So, I mean, we all do live in a pragmatic world, and principles are great. But, you know, being able to employ journalists who will do very important kind of societal work is also important. So it's a balancing act. I think the organizations that are doing it well at the moment, certainly in the last, you know, since 24 months ago that the bottom started falling out of online advertising in terms of just display ads, the organizations that are doing well at the moment are the ones that have very strong brands and very strong affinity and have been like converting their occasional readers into paying subscribers. And along with that, we see, you know, a move away from kind of bigger news organizations to bigger general news organizations to niche news verticals. So, you know, you would see the likes of The Athletic, Axios, and Business Insider in the US is a really good example of a kind of focusing on a core area of technology and providing really important insight that you just can't get anywhere else. So there's a very kind of unique outlook and a unique kind of commissioning ethos as well. And also they build nice communities, and you can go to events and meet like-minded people and gossip about Elon Musk in the case of the information.
And as you say, with either the transfer of traditional advertising from traditional publishers to the social media platforms, the collapse of display advertising, organizations like your own, like the Irish Times, need to find other sources of revenue. That subscription model behind paywall, where premium content or indeed all content has to be paid for through a subscription model, monthly or annual payments. How's that journey going for INM? And can, given a population, the population size we have, can that succeed in Ireland, do you think, over time?
Do you know what? If you had asked me this a few years ago, I would have been really skeptical. But I think it's more a necessity now to be able to have a direct relationship with your readers, regardless of what type of media outlet you are and the size of the market that you exist in. So again, I mean, in INM's case, we launched a paywall, I think it was actually 12 months and 7 days ago now. So we've had a subscription service on independent.ie and Belfast Telegraph for that amount of time now. And across the two titles, we're almost at currently 40,000 in contract subscribers. So that's not accounting for churn. So that is far exceeded where we thought we would be now. That some of that is down to an awful lot of hard work. Some of that is down to the fact that INM was purchased by the Belgian company Media House, and we got a lot of learnings from their take on how they build subscription models and a direct relationship with subscribers. So I think for me, the proof is that even in a small market like Ireland, it's possible. You can do it. It's going to take hard work and a lot of investment, but it also is going to take a strong and recognizable brand like the Irish Independent or independent.ie or Newstalk. That, you know, it's the toothbrush test in some ways in brands and news, in a brand and news sphere, that, you know, people will recognize the brand and want to visit it or use it once or twice a day.
Yeah, although we're free to air and will be for a long time, you have to pay for, validly have to pay for your content behind the paywall now, Steve. And is it also critical, and I know you're on the product side as much as content, is it also critical, do you think, over time that organizations like your own expand and extend the types of products that they sell to those people who have joined the club?
I think, yeah, I mean, a few years ago, there was a big line in kind of diversification of kind of news services and how kind of news entities needed to operate. And there certainly was a perception that if you were a news organization, you needed to have subscription, you needed to have an advertising model, you needed to have an events business, you needed to have some sort of shop, and you needed to have a catalogue of other kind of associated businesses that could kind of feed off the inherent trust that comes from a news organization. I think people are now focusing on just getting one part of that puzzle correct. And increasingly, it seems to me that it's the kind of direct-to-consumer kind of version of news consumption that is around that. I think seeing the huge growth in the likes of, you know, Disney Plus and Netflix only proves, even though those are far bigger international brands with huge back catalogs of content that they can monetize, but they only prove that is a very sustainable model if you get the backing right. I do think one of the interesting things that could well happen is this kind of direct-to-consumer model could expand. You can see this kind of turning into how kind of coffee shops run, instead of going in and buying when we can all get back to kind of working in offices and buying coffee, instead of like going and buying your individual coffee a day, you could have a subscription to a particular coffee shop and you could get, you know, coffee on tap. I think there's a lot more innovation that can come in the real world out of the kind of subscription style modeling and the direct-to-consumer mindset that comes with that. And look, we've seen that in other areas, like, you know, Warby Parker with glasses and Dollar Shave Club. These are companies that have fundamentally realigned how they think about their relationship with their customer, with their supply chain, with their customer, and their marketing to the customer. And they're realizing a lot of value by doing that. So I think news is doing that. I think we're going to see a lot of other businesses in other sectors do that as well.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Interesting to see whether there will be any boomerang effect around the world from what's happening in Australia at the moment in terms of who pays for what, in terms of news content. And the best of luck on your own journey with INM in terms of paywall and increasing your subscription numbers. That's Steve Dempsey, Group Director of Publishing Products at Independent News and Media. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Vincent.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.